de la revolución del mundo.
Justice by any means necessary.
This program is brought to you by Haymarket Books as part of the Socialism 2024 program. You can hear more recordings from the conference by subscribing to the Socialism Conference podcast feed. Many video recordings are also available at socialismconference.org. If you enjoy these recordings, you should join us at Socialism 2025, which will be held in Chicago next summer, July 3rd through the 6th, 2025. If you are ready to put ideas into action and get organized with others from across the country and the world, make a plan with your organization and your friends to come to the Socialism Conference.
Okay, so we'll go ahead and get started. Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us today for this panel on demilitarization and climate justice. My name is Meijin Cha. I'm an assistant professor at the University of California at Santa Cruz, a fellow at the Climate Jobs Institute at Cornell University, and a fellow at the Climate and Community Project, soon to be a Climate and Community Institute. I'm thrilled and honored to be part of this panel with these amazing speakers. Just to give a bit of a roadmap, I'll start with a few remarks to help frame the panel. And then we'll begin by sharing an opening question amongst all participants, followed by questions for each of our participants to get further into why demilitarization is essential to a just transition. And then we'll open it up for floor discussion, where I encourage you to keep your comments and questions brief, and also we'll be taking a progressive stack. So just a few words about the importance of this moment and this panel. Broadly speaking, just transition refers to understanding what challenges arise from decarbonization and the ways in which these challenges can be addressed. The idea of just transition is becoming more mainstream in climate discussions and is even making its way into climate negotiations. That more people and organizations are talking about this idea is good in the fact that it indicates that there is an acknowledgement of the need for considerations beyond emissions reductions when we're thinking about climate change, but as that term becomes more mainstream, it is becoming co-opted. What is meant to be a radical re-envisioning is becoming a neoliberalized concept. Just transition is not only about moving from fossil fuels to renewable energy. It is not only about what happens to fossil fuel workers and what kind of jobs are created in a carbon-free economy. Just transition is a world-making project that fights for a more just future for everyone, everywhere. And the reason we must protect this vision of just transition is because we will not reach the climate targets we need to preserve this planet without the broader, more holistic, more ambitious vision of decarbonization. We need a vision that moves from systems of extraction, and by that I mean extraction of resources, people, and wealth, to systems of regeneration, and that is fundamental to both decarbonization and fundamental to a just transition. A militarized world is incompatible with this vision. From the carbon emissions of bombing campaigns to the resource extraction necessary to build these humanity-destroying weapons, we will never reach our climate targets without demilitarization. But of course, demilitarization is a complex and politically challenging issue, which is why I'm so thrilled to have these brilliant minds here to help us discuss and navigate some of these challenges. So with us today, we have Dr. Patrick Bigger, Research Director at the Climate and Community Project, author of numerous pieces on the link between imperialism and climate crisis. Cam Rogali, Senior Researcher at Commonwealth, a think tank in the UK. He leads their research program on the military-industrial complex and the potential for a just transition towards civilian production. Jesse Kelly, UAW Local 160, GM Warren Tech Center Skills Trade Moldmaker, and co-chair of UAWD Palestine Solidarity and Peace Economy Committee. And Sumaya Awad, a Palestinian organizer and writer based in New York. She is Director of Strategy at the Dala Justice Project and co-editor of Palestine, A Social Introduction. So to begin, I'd like to ask you all, what does just transition mean to you, and how does it appear in your work?
Thanks so much, Meijin, and thanks to all of y'all for showing up for the first session of the day on what I think is a very vital concept and set of confluences, nexuses, and intersections if we're going to achieve just transition for a peaceful world that builds genuine human security as the climate crisis intensifies. Like Meijin said, my name is Patrick. I use he, him pronouns, research director at the Climate and Community Institute. And I want to take this question sort of in a narrow way and then maybe in a broader way. So there's this like sort of narrow approach to just transitions as it's conception, you know, historically been thought about going way back in an energy transition sense that's really focused on workers in the fossil fuel industry in particular. I want to broaden that out to think about the military industry as such. I think Jesse and Kim can talk about the specifics of workers themselves a little bit. Maybe I can set the scene a little bit, and then I want to zoom out to think about the role of militarism in the climate crisis more broadly, and the imperative for reducing the scope and remit of the U.S. war machine in particular. So the U.S. military is a climate villain of world historical proportions, and there's any number of reasons that we can critique the operations of the U.S. military. But going all the way back really to the genesis of the fossil economy, we can think about the role of the U.S. and the U.K. militaries in, the 20th century colonization of West Asia in order to make the ground safe, literally, for extraction. Or we can think about the switch from coal-fired to oil-fired ships in the early 20th century that necessitated the change from recoaling stations to oil refueling stations across, like, Southeast Asia, the Pacific, Latin America, etc. They really build the infrastructure for the global fossil economy that is driving the climate crisis. So we can think about this in a historical sense, and then we can also think about it in the contemporary sense. The U.S. military, if it was its own country, would be about the 40th largest emitter on Earth on a proportional basis to other countries. So it's an emitter the size of a country like Portugal or Sweden. On a per capita basis, the U.S. military would be the biggest emitter in the world, about 42 tons per capita, which is 10 more than Qatar, which is currently the biggest per capita emitter. And then that's to say nothing of all the other ecological impacts, right? The climate crisis is only one dimension of the broader ecological crisis in which we find ourselves. So arms manufacturing requires a ton of mining, which drives biodiversity loss. The use of chemical retardants and firefighting gels that are chock full of PFAS that are poisoning water supplies from Okinawa to Japan to Puerto Rico. There's all sorts of ways in which the U.S. military has incredibly detrimental impacts on both local communities and the global community as a contributor to the climate crisis. So it's just worth bearing in mind that the U.S. military is, as far as we can tell, the biggest institutional consumer of fossil fuels in the world. So not producer, making the ground safe for extraction and then consuming more of that than any other institution on Earth. So confronting the U.S. military and its capacity to consume fuel itself is a critical part of a just transition in the climate crisis. And one of the ways that we need to confront this is through the outrageous military spending of the U.S. You know, so the NDAA, the National Defense Authorization Act, that is comes up for renewal every year, is currently in conference between the House and Senate versions, will spend, with a little bit of rounding, about $1 trillion next year on the military-industrial complex, which is 10 times more than will be spent on climate through the Inflation Reduction Act. So 10x more on war, on genocide, on consuming fuel that's going to turbocharge the climate crisis. So that is an extremely critical legislative space in which we have to think about how militarism and climate are intersecting. And furthermore, 60% of that military budget is going to go to private contractors, particularly the big five arms manufacturing firms. And here's where we start getting into some of the kind of jobs dimensions of a just transition. If we look at the U.S. military itself, both active duty personnel and civilian personnel, that's about 2.1 million people, with a further 2.2 million people in aerospace and defense jobs. So what, 4.5 million people in a country of 330 million? So this is a substantial chunk of the workforce, and four times bigger than the fossil fuel workforce, right? So we need a just transition for fossil fuel workers for sure, but also for all these folks in defense and defense adjacent industries, from active duty military personnel to the folks who work on building the munitions that are then dropped on Gazans or being sent to Ukraine, wherever. And this is really important because the war industry is woven into the fabric of communities across the country. So we can think about the boondoggle F-35 project that's going to cost like $4 trillion rather over its lifespan, that sources parts from every single state in the U.S. as well as like 17 allied countries. So we're talking about really distributed economic effects of this military-industrial complex that are deeply woven into the fabric of communities and workforces, and just the real importance of bringing folks along in a transition to a warmer world, but hopefully a more peaceful one as well. That's just on the domestic side. If we take the more expansive approach to a just transition, we have to think about U.S. empire as it's currently constituted and the 750 or so overseas military bases that the U.S. continues to operate around the world, many of which, DOD doesn't even publish its own accounting of this. The best accounting we have is from a researcher called David Vine at American University. So we don't even know how big the extent of this is or where all these bases are, but we know that they are antithetical to a more peaceful world. And furthermore, just think about all those far-flung bases and the logistical work and all the fuel that's spent getting folks and materials and even more fuel to those bases. And so shrinking the footprint of U.S. empire is an immediate climate priority. And then the last thing that I want to say is that one of the key ironies here is that the U.S. Department of Defense has taken climate change more seriously than almost any other federal agency across administrations, largely because they have the sort of policy wherewithal to set their own priorities. So they're actually investing in things like seawalls at Hampton Roads, Virginia, or base electrification in the Midwest to get off the grid because they need a reliable power supply. So DOD is already taking this seriously, and one of the kind of new findings that I wanted to share from our current research is that DOD is aiming to electrify its fleet of non-combat ground vehicles by 2035, which means that all that copper and cobalt and lithium that's desperately needed for a civilian energy transition is instead going to be dumped into military manufacturing. And our work shows that if we didn't do that, if we just cut the size of the military and instead put those materials towards better uses, you could electrify the entire Postal Service fleet, the entire National Park Service fleet, and add battery backup to every single federal building in America at the same material cost as electrifying the DOD's ground vehicle fleet of sedans and buses and stuff that they use to ferry around all of these bases. So those are just some kind of overarching considerations to think about when we're considering a just transition away from militarism and towards safer climates. Thanks.
So I'm going to talk a bit about the concept and practice of a peace economy transition. So the idea of repurposing or converting capacity that exists within the military industry or the military industrial complex towards civilian sectors or green sectors, basically alternative production instead of the war machine. So why think about a just transition in that context? I mean, there's an immediate answer, which I think Patrick covered excellently, which is recognizing the ecological, social damage and destruction that result from the maintenance of a permanent war economy or a war machine, also the geopolitical instability that it produces. And in recognizing that we need to scale back that war machine, that we need an alternative, also creating alternative jobs and alternative pathways for workers within that. But I think the idea of a just transition also raises another set of questions there, and it allows us to think more broadly. It allows us to think about the different interests at play within the military-industrial complex and to consider the interests of workers within it, and to not just kind of fall for the superficial line that you get from companies within the military-industrial complex, from governments that want to increase military spending, that will say that these workers are aligned in their interests with the shareholders of the companies, with an expanded foreign policy, with overseas intervention, et cetera, to actually think in the long term, what are the interests of workers who are involved in kind of manufacturing the different components of a war economy. And if we start thinking about that, what it leads us to is a long history of organizing for this peace transition that's come from within the labor movement, it's come from workers' movements and worker organization in the US, but also in the UK. So gonna talk a little bit about that history and also some present research that I've been doing with workers who are in the military industry in the UK as well. So from the start of the permanent war economy in the US, you had workers fighting for alternatives, you had trade unions fighting for alternatives. Jesse's here from the UAW. The UAW in the wake of the Second World War were really at the forefront of that, arguing that the government owned plants that had been set up to kind of fuel the Second World War economy, rather than just being shut down and workers losing their jobs, or just being maintained as part of a war machine, actually needed to be converted and maintained back to civilian production to produce parts for railroad, to produce prefab housing for returning veterans. That was unsuccessful, and what we saw instead was the maintenance of a permanent war economy. But you saw that the labor organizing was there right from the beginning. And that continued in the US in the late 70s and early 80s with the IAM. We've seen it over and over again within the US military industrial complex, but it's also been there in the UK. The most famous example of that, and I think many of you will have heard of it, is the Lucas Plan, which was a group of workers at a company called Lucas Aerospace in the 1970s from all across the UK, who were basically involved in making parts for military aircraft. And they came together democratically through their trade union, and they came up with an alternative plan that was for the conversion of production at their factories to produce parts for 155 different civilian products, which they decided on through an audit of their own skills, but also for worker governance of production. And it was at a time where nationalisation in the British economy was much more widespread, so they saw that worker governance as a kind of democratic form of nationalisation. But a lot of the time, people just think of this Lucas Plan, and they focus on that group of Lucas Aerospace workers, when in reality, it was much more a Lucas moment, where you had workers all across the military-industrial complex in the US and UK, partly inspired by workers at Lucas Aerospace, partly in direct collaboration and coordination with them. The Lucas Aerospace workers were constantly coming over to the US as well, and in several companies developing these alternative plans. It didn't succeed. There was opposed by management. It was opposed, you know, that the government resources weren't redirected as they would have needed to have been to successfully deliver that transition. But you can see that the organizing and the vision has been there within parts of the labor movement for a very long time. So what are we seeing at present? So over the last year, I've been doing these interviews with workers in trade unions, workers and trade unionists from across the military industrial complex within the UK. And I think that there are some key takeaways that I can talk about very briefly. The first of which is that the military industrial complex as it exists today has been transformed. Jobs in the MIC in the UK have halved since 1980. So, you know, the idea that it's this secure source of employment is not really true. It's also become much more capital intensive, much more research intensive, and the unions in Britain are much weaker now as well. But within that context, and if you view it within the context of the British economy more widely, there's still more public investment, more industrial capacity concentrated within our much smaller than your war machine. But it's still there compared to other civilian parts of the economy. So the prospect of repurposing some of that capacity is there. And I think what I really took away from the interviews was that, actually I remember speaking to Jessie online at one point and her mentioning something similar, that technologically this is a very feasible transition to make. But people really saw that their skills could be used in other ways. And lots of them had a real sense of a missed opportunity. They'd be working at a naval shipyard and imported wind turbines would be coming down the river in front of them. And they'd feel that rather than there being job losses at their shipyard, there could have been another way, another direction for their work to go into that was in those kind of green energy sectors. I also saw the fact that lots of these naval shipyards, four of them in Britain, already do work in green energy and green transport. They just won't really talk about it as much because they'll want to maintain the focus on military contracts and military spending. So the skills and capacity are there. But I think what really came away from, you know, what I really took away from that was beyond just the skills and capacity, the fact that there's public investment in the war machine was also striking, but it's obviously not there in these alternative sectors in Britain at the moment. We don't have publicly owned energy or procurement from that you would need, or the same in green transport at scale. And people were making those points that they would need that kind of public procurement in order to see this transition unfold successfully. There's an organizing opportunity in kind of labor movements, climate movements, anti-war movements. And I think that kind of just transition peace economy part of it is extremely important to draw a different set of interests into the anti-war movement as it currently stands.
Hi, I'm Jessie. So just like they explained to you, I think that there's just this really awesome opportunity that we have in society right now where we can start really like bringing a conversation up with working class people and asking them, what would it look like if you felt good about the things that you contribute to society? We have the workforce there. We have the money there. We have the infrastructure there. What we don't have is we don't have the people power, because we need to empower all of those workers to like be able to make better demands, organize amongst themselves, and feel empowered enough to say, I don't want to contribute to society in a way that is, you know, genocide and killing people and destroying our planet. And instead, what would it look like if we used our manufacturing power to contribute to society, to create great things for our infrastructure, to be able to care for each other more? And so that's kind of the element that I think about a lot. And I think that we're in a really pivotal time in society right now where maybe we can open up that conversation and get workers thinking about it and empowering them. And I think that we can do that a lot through labor unions. And that's kind of the element that I'm bringing to it. I come from the UAW. I'm an auto worker. And I know that a lot of the auto workers felt really, really afraid when we talked about transitioning into an EV, which brought me into this work. I was one of those auto workers. I heard about how it's going to be 40% less components transitioning from an internal combustion engine to EV, and you get scared. And unfortunately, a lot of workers will make these really bad decisions when they're scared, and they feel like they can't morally do what they want to do. They are kind of forced to pay their bills, keep a roof over their head, provide for their children. So you just morally check out and you go to work and you're actually fighting against your own interests because you're not empowered enough to be able to demand more and think about a bigger picture of what society could look like. And I think by opening up these conversations and workers understanding they don't have to be afraid, if they come together, we could all do something that makes us all feel really, really good. Then we'll stop kind of fighting against ourselves, right? Or like voting against our own self-interests and all of these things. And so I just think about that a lot, and my own fear of the transitioning into an EV and the way I felt about it, and then realizing, going a step further and realizing that like this actually needs to happen. And there is a world where we can both breathe the air and have food on our table. And I just want, you know, the weapons manufacturing workers to feel the same exact ways.
Agree with everything that's been said. The first thing I think about when I think about just transition, and I'm trying to explain it to someone that hasn't heard about it before, is just that it's about recalibrating our priorities from profit to people, and on every level. So like the workers that are involved in these various industries, the people that pay the price for what is built out of these industries and what happens, Gaza being the you know, top of the list right now, and then what it means for all of us down the line and for generations to come. But I'm not going to go on a tangent. But I think about just transition in the Middle East and about what that looks like in Palestine and across the Middle East and North Africa. It's really impossible to talk about a just transition without underscoring the need for Israel's occupation to end. And the fact that Israel's project from the very beginning, from 1948, and before that, when it was still being conceived, part of it is an ecocide. It's a genocide against the land and the earth and the trees and the water and everything. And that I'm not saying it as like a symbolic, like sounds poetic, but that part and by design, Zionism and Israeli apartheid and occupation and genocide intentionally wanted to completely ruin and desecrate the native land and the water and everything that comes with that. And I'll give examples of that later on in the panel. But I say this because often when we're talking about climate and sometimes with just transition, and someone, I don't remember who, but on the panel already talked about the ways these things are co-opted. And one of the ways that we often see them co-opted is by making it seem like an apolitical thing, that we can talk about this without going into, you know, the political questions that might divide us, and we don't want to be divisive, and that it's actually incredibly important that we hold on to things like Palestine and other things that are deemed divisive, because they are so integrally, materially connected to what we're trying to dismantle and to the system that we're trying to rehaul. And with Palestine and the U.S. military-industrial complex, the links are like in the dozens. And one of the most important examples and probably top of mind, and I assume a lot of people already know this, but I'll repeat it, is the fact that most of the military funding that goes to Israel every year, it's 3.5 million a year, but that has gone up in the last year because of the genocide, including $20 billion that Anthony Blinken approved just a few weeks ago. But a large sum of that military funding, it's stipulated in the agreement between the U.S. and Israel, that a large part of that sum has to be spent on weapons and arms from the U.S. that are built in the U.S. And so it is directly profiting and directly helping to sustain and rebuild the U.S. military-industrial complex and the amount of money that we spend on it. And this is, I think the way the question was phrased for the panelist was, how does just transition sort of relate to your work? And I work on Palestine at the Adala Justice Project. And one of the questions that we faced again and again in the last 10 months of this genocide is, you know, that we are fighting for a full arms embargo, right? And that we want the U.S. to stop sending weapons to Israel, to stop sending the bombs raining down on Palestinians. And of course, we've hit a wall with our government because they're not listening, and they just say things and then send more money and more weapons. And so we then transition to, well, how can we work with the workers that are building these bombs and who don't want to be building these bombs? And poll after poll has shown this, that they don't want to be doing this. What does it mean to work with the workers for these factories to be shut down, for them not to build them? And of course, the only answer is just transition. And it's the kind of thing where if 10 years ago we had been able to build and fight for and achieve a just transition, then we wouldn't be in this particular situation right now. And so that's probably one of the main reasons that I think just transition is so, so important for us in the Palestine movement and for any anti-imperialist movement.
Thank you all so much. Ken, maybe I'll start with you. If you could just talk, you mentioned very briefly the Lucas Plan, but if you could talk just a little bit about more what that was, and then also what lessons could be learned from labor movements like the Lucas Plan.
Oh, sorry. Oh, I'll go for this one. So the Lucas Plan came about in 1974, was the kind of the genesis moment when Tony Benn, who was then the Secretary of State for Industry, went against the recommendations of his own civil servants and the trade union bureaucracy of workers in the military industry, and invited basically the rank and file representatives, the shop floor representatives of workers at Lucas Aerospace into the department, and said, you know, your company's, you've been losing jobs at your company over previous years. Do you want to be nationalized? And the answer that workers gave, and I was lucky enough to interview a couple of people who were part of that meeting, is a kind of a yes and, in that they wanted nationalization, but they also wanted democratic control over production, and they wanted greater role of workers' governance over production. And at that point, you know, they weren't anti-imperialists at that point. They were more thinking about protecting their jobs and their own economic security because of the job losses that had happened around them. But through this industrial democracy that they were kind of fighting for, they then went and did an audit of their members, an audit of the workforce, for people to talk about their skills and what kind of products that they could build instead of parts for military aircraft with those skills. And that's when they got these 155 ideas back from the workforce of different civilian products, included things like wind turbines, included heat pumps, all sorts of things that are now kind of cutting edge green technology today, or not really cutting edge, but, you know, important green technology today. And it was really through that process of kind of democratic trade unionism that they evolved this plan and became anti-war through it, kind of looked for alternatives to the military sector organically when they were asked what they actually wanted to do through their own skills and their own creativity. In terms of what we can learn from that, I think on the one hand, it shows the importance of that democracy, of worker governance, of rank and file organizing, because this was ultimately a rank and file project. But in its rejection, which came through company management, who said that there wasn't a market for wind turbines, by the way, basically what then happened was that they weren't supported by the state in the way that they thought they were going to be. And I think it's a lesson of both rank and file organizing, but also of trying to build enough power and build enough pressure to get the state to also do the necessary, make the necessary investments, divert the necessary capacity for that to be realized. Because the those two things need to come together. While the alternative plan was amazing, it couldn't come into being without a diversion of resource away from military spending and towards these alternative projects, which is what they were asking for. So yeah, I would say that would be like a key takeaway for the present.
Now, Jesse, I'm wondering if we continue on this theme of kind of workers and the production of their labor, can you talk a little bit about the moral injury that workers face when they have to do harmful work? And following up from that, then what kind of demands can they make, you know, when it comes to doing this work or not doing this type of work?
Yeah, so I think there's this really interesting argument that can be made that, like, if we go into work and we break our arm, right, we get workman's comp, we're able to go off, we're able to heal from that. But what about the parts of you that break your soul, right, and break your mind? Like, if you're going into work and you're creating bombs and then you go home and you turn on, you know, the TV and you see the thing that you just created just wipe out human life, I don't think that there's enough, like, you know, enough thought about how that hurts people. And so our argument is, there should be a moral injury clause. And we should say that, like, we should also recognize that these workers are being hurt in this way, and what can they demand when they are hurt this way. And some of the demands that we came up with were things like, inside of their labor agreements, they should be able to, without retaliation, say, I'm not working on this project, and be able to be given a different project inside of the plan. This is why I like the Lucas plan so much too, because it's this idea that the workers are able to have a say over the things that they're producing. And maybe we demand that. Maybe we demand that the workers, through democratic process, are able to talk about the things that they want to make and what their manufacturing power is being used for in society. And we also want to talk about demands inside of their contract that look like tuition assistance programs, so that as we move from a just transition, we also give education to these workers so that they are able to work in a different sector or into a different job inside of society and be able to perform well.
Great, thank you. So Maya, can I ask, you mentioned very briefly the environmental impact of Israel's ecocide, and you know, for people, for folks like that work in the climate movement, there has been kind of this deafening silence from the climate movement about Gaza and the genocide that's occurring. So I wonder if you could just talk a little bit more about the environmental impacts of this war on Gaza, and then also kind of ways in which climate activism and climate justice can engage with anti-imperialism and these struggles.
Yeah, all in 5 minutes.
Please feel free to take as much time as you need.
No, I'll be brief. I mean, I think like a very cursory look at what's happening in Gaza just shows you the impact it's having on the environment. And I think it's easy to think, and I often do, including when I was thinking about how to answer this question, like, what does it matter for me to talk about the agricultural land that's been destroyed and the water aquifers and the sanitation plants and the electricity grids and all the infrastructure that's been destroyed, when nearly 200,000 people have been killed? And so it's important, and it's important because Israel chooses to destroy the environment in order to make this space uninhabitable. That it's by design that they choose to destroy agricultural land. It's by design that they chose to flood the tunnels in Gaza, and by doing so destroy all the fresh water. That they force the sanitation plants to close, meaning that all the sewage is just dumped into the Mediterranean, and that means fishing in the Mediterranean is not possible when that's like one of the only places that people in Gaza can go for food while they're being bombed. The amount, the CO2, the carbon dioxide that's a result of the bombs that have fallen is amounts to the emissions of around 20 countries. It's 281,315 tons. I don't totally understand what to make of that number, but it's a very big number. And to see all of that, and this is just like the surface level, right? This isn't even talking about like the 75 years of what Israel's occupation and apartheid across Palestine from the river to the sea has done to the environment. One example that I actually like to talk about, because I think it really shows how much of this is by design and not like the accidents of war and like the outcome of war, is the fact that most of the native vegetation in Palestine has been uprooted or burnt down or just completely destroyed, desecrated. And in its place, non-native species have been planted. And the organization that does this most is actually a US-based organization called the Jewish National Fund, which prides itself as being like a charitable, environmental, like, you know, climate activism organization, when in fact, under this charity status, it's actively destroying Palestinian villages and towns and building on them pine trees, imported pine trees that are not native to the land, that completely destroy the local ecology. And I'm not talking like 10,000, 20,000. They planted over 240 million trees, majority of them pine trees, on the remains of these Palestinian villages, and still do this today. They go door knocking, like sort of like Girl Scouts, but they're not. And do it all under this, like, look, we're environmentally friendly. Like, don't talk about politics because that's divisive. And I think the environmental movement in the U.S. is like, someone needs to shake them and say, what are you doing? How can you talk about the environment without talking about what Israel is doing? How can we take you seriously? How do you expect any person that's involved in anti-imperialism and anti-war movements in the U.S. to take seriously the climate movement when it's turning a blind eye to these, to this, just like these war crimes against the environment? And that it actually comes back to hurt us here. It's not this like foreign policy issue, right? It directly impacts here because of the way that the military-industrial complex impacts everything that's happening here. It has everything to do with workers' rights and healthcare and a number of other things. And Israel is the 10th largest arms exporter in the world and number one per capita. And that means something. It has everything to do with the military-industrial complex and has everything to do with why our government is still supporting Israel despite the fact that there's a genocide happening and the fact that the majority of Americans, poll after poll shows, are against the genocide and don't want the government to support it. And so it goes back to that question of profit. And I think that's at the heart of all of this. I went on a tangent. I'll stop there.
Thank you. I think that's a good segue, Patrick, to this idea that can you even green the military, right? Like, you hear about this, the carbon footprint of it, but something that has come up is that a lot of climate people, and even you mentioned like the adaptation measures that the military has done and all of this, but like, do you think we can actually green the military?
No. No, this is like one of Liz Warren's like big policy planks in her 2020 campaign, was that we were gonna green the military and have the greenest empire the world has ever seen. And like, this is like a nonsense, obviously, for all sorts of reasons, not the least of which are the like catastrophic effects of US weaponry where they're deployed, as we see in Gaza right now. I'll come back to the emissions numbers. We can add some context to that. But like, I think one of the fundamental insights that's helpful to keep in mind, our colleagues of the Cost of War Project at Brown University did some calculations looking back to like the surge era in Iraq, right? If you remember that back in like 06, 07, we're gonna put a ton of boots on the ground and like, you know, rat out, you know, eliminate all resistance once and for all. Of course, that was unsuccessful. But if you look at the CO2 emissions that were happening at that time, those still only represented 30% of DOD CO2 emissions. So 70% were from non-combat activities. So that means just the maintenance of empire as it's currently constituted, both domestic forces and the 750 bases all around the world, are going to be carbon intensive no matter what the sort of like US state of how many adventures we're having overseas at any given time are, right? So on the one hand, there's just like the pure infrastructural aspect. And then there's the problem of the fossil lock-in with specific weapon systems. So like, to go back to the F-35, the F-35 is actually 40% less fuel efficient than the F-16 that it replaces. So on a per mile basis, it burns 40% more jet fuel. And jet fuel is by far the biggest contributor to global warming of all of the U.S. military's activities. So I think it's probably in the 75 to 80% of all emissions are from burning fossil fuels in airplanes. And there is no plausible pathway to decarbonizing aviation anytime in the next, I don't know, 20, 30, 40 years. If anybody ever says, like, sustainable aviation fuel, you can immediately call bullshit, right? It's, like, on par with carbon offsetting or, like, you know, reducing emissions from forestry, right? Like, it's nonsense. And so there's just no meaningful way, and especially when the U.S. continues to plow trillions of dollars into these weapon systems, it's incredibly difficult to imagine a world in which all that money is put into weapon systems and they just like leave them on the tarmac, right? They're going to get flown. Right? This is like one of the major problems with continually pumping all of this money into military contractors, right? Is that you have to have turnover of stock. And if you have to have turnover of stock and munitions, that means killing people with them, because that's what the military's stated goal is, right? Is to break things and kill people, and that's what these munitions do. And so to think that like we could decarbonize those processes, in addition to just completely occluding all of the ethical considerations around what the U.S. military gets up to with its allies and their militaries, it doesn't make sense if we're really serious about a steep, quickly bending the curve on decarbonization. And then just to contextualize those emission figures in Palestine real quick, because I think it is instructive here, the 286,000 tons or whatever from direct Israeli military operations, like, it doesn't mean anything in the grand scheme of things. What it actually shows, I think, is the fundamental asymmetry in the quote-unquote conflict. When we can, 99% of the emissions in the first 60 days in 120 days of the war that we calculated accrued to Israel and the U.S., while 1% accrued to Palestinian resistance. So it's basically nothing, right? It's a way of illustrating the fundamental asymmetry. But like, I think even more pointedly is something that the UN Special Rapporteur for Human Rights and the Environment said, that we have a dwindling carbon budget, and war is an idiotic way to spend that remaining carbon budget. And so, like, these are all discretionary emissions when we should be doing everything that we can to rapidly reduce emissions. So the global warming numbers from the genocide, not particularly important, but they illustrate the asymmetry, and they represent a real problem that we have in achieving a just transition, both in Gaza and around the world.
I could ask questions all day, but I want to give room for the audience. So I have one more question for Jesse and maybe Kim. And so if you want to all start lining up, if you have questions for the panelists, again, I would encourage you to keep them short so we can hear from as many people as possible. But as folks start to line up, Jesse and Kim, I'm wondering if you could talk about concrete policies that we could think about that would actually help protect workers as we transition into this peace economy.
Something that people might not know about the history of the UAW is that Walter Ruther actually called for a peaceful transition. He called it a peace transition from a war economy to a peace economy. And his idea of it was that 25% that weapons manufacturing industries, that 25% of the profit that they would make would have to go into a fund, and then that fund would go to educating the workers, and so that they were able to transition out of that work and into different sectors. And so I think that that is something that we could like go back over, research, push for. It was like he was calling for it right before his death, so I don't think that we actually got to see the whole, you know, it play out exactly what was all going on in his mind at that time. And I think that it's an awesome starting point and something that we could build off from there. Some other things that we talked about was in the short term, we want the workers to be able to refuse to use their labor to contribute to genocide, free from punishment and retaliation, and get that inside of their contract. Protection from layoffs, including 2 years of subpay. So subpay is just where the company has to pay you if you're laid off. You get your unemployment, and then they bring you up to your rate of pay. This gives empowers a lot of workers because they know that they're kind of protected for those 2 years and that they are able to like go back into the workforce. Full health insurance and tuition assistance if they choose to refuse a job. And an expanded grievance procedure that recognizes that mass protests against overseas genocide as a health and safety issue so that workers can ultimately grieve and strike over. that the UAW or other labor movements will help them move into different sectors that aren't contributing to the war economy. And then jobs banks. So auto workers used to have jobs banks, which was a place that workers would go and the company would pay them while they're there, but they didn't actually have to use their manufacturing power. And then the long-term provision would be a conversion plan like Walter Reuther had idea.
Yeah, just to add to that, that Walter Reuther policy was then followed by the IAM in the late 70s and early 80s, and they were campaigning for it at a federal level. And this really became like a mainstream policy demand within and outside of the labor movement. So far, it went so far that kind of in the wake of the Cold War, you had in Bill Clinton's inaugural speech as president, he was mentioning this idea of a peace transition, which obviously wasn't delivered. And in reality, they decided to use the kind of the limited window between the end of the Cold War and the start of the so-called war on terror to use the kind of small cuts in military spending to fund deficit reduction instead of any sort of transition for workers or conversion of industrial capacity. So you can see how these things can be done extremely badly as well. In that same moment, you had the arms companies ramping up shareholder payouts while also laying off their workers at the same time. It was a crazy, crazy trip. But what we're calling for in the UK, so we're publishing a report at Commonwealth in October, which will be based on these interviews. And our focus really is on how public ownership can be used to support this kind of transition. So we're calling for the founding of a publicly owned organization that can basically take ownership of military industrial sites and guide them through a conversion process, and also investment in the kind of the skills and training that Jesse was mentioning as well. As well as the diversion of military budgets, the diversion of university capacity because of how much universities are used by the war machine to perform free work to develop weapons. So various policies will be in that report. And the final thing I'll mention as well, in the UK, we're really crying out for the return of a political strike. I mean, if there is a policy demand that would be useful in the immediate term, it would be workers being able to take strike action over things such as complicity in this genocide. So I would say that's a kind of a short-term policy demand that could have a massive impact.
Thanks for listening. If you liked this episode, subscribe to our podcast and to the Haymarket Books YouTube channel, where events like this one are hosted live. And don't forget to check out haymarketbooks.org.